Okay. Today is March 3rd, 2014. This is Fidencio Marbella with the Westchester Public Library in Westchester, Illinois. Also present is Patrick Callahan, a reference librarian here at Westchester. Today we will be speaking with Mr. Martin Patton. Marty grew up in Chicago, was born there on July 12, 1922. He served in the U.S. Army from October of 42 through February of 46. This interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. Okay, Marty, why don't you tell us where and when you were born and a little bit about your family growing up?
Well, I had one sister, and I grew up with my mother, father, and an aunt and uncle. My uncle lived there all the time. My aunt was a rebel. She'd get in fights with him and move out. When she felt like coming back, she'd come back. It didn't matter what anybody else thought. I went to St. Gregory's Grammar School on the north side, and then I went to Loyola Academy. It was over by the lake at that time. It wasn't what it is now, you know. It only had 400 boys in it. And they moved to Wilmette, and they got a big school now, you know. And interestingly, they decided that one of the girls' schools was going to close, apparently because of a lack of enrollment, you know. And Loyola decided to take the girls in. And that caused a lot of trouble with some of the alumni. They didn't like that. Until that year, the girls won the basketball championship for the state, and they were welcomed with open arms. I worked for about 2 years after high school, and I did insulation work on buildings. So then the draft come along, and I tried to join, and I couldn't join. And then I get drafted. They relax the requirements.
Okay. Why did they turn you down when you tried to join?
I had 2400 vision in my right eye. Okay. I have it, except when I got out of Penn State, they needed combat troops, and it became 20/20. Not bad.
It's a miracle.
it was interesting in that I eventually wound up with this 11th Engineer Battalion, and they were in Florida, and they were at an island called Fort Pierce, and it's about halfway between Jacksonville and Miami, and there were 25,000 sailors on it, and 600 of us from the Army. Now, one advantage of it, we wore tans, and the sailors didn't know the difference. They thought we were officers.
Oh, okay. Naval officers.
Yeah. So we'd get primary seats in the movie, you know. What we were doing down there, we were going north to a small island about 10 miles up the coast, and they were uninhabited. There was nobody on them. And what we were doing is they would fly over the coast of France and take photographs. And they'd take photographs of the beaches and the fortifications, the pillboxes. Then they'd fly them to Florida, and we'd build them. And then they practiced blowing them up, you know. But, oh, it was hot. Ooh. You know, wheeling cement all day. Oh, boy. But it was interesting. Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to when you were drafted. That was, October of 42?
Right.
Where did you do your basic training?
Camp McCoy.
Okay, well, Wisconsin?
Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, did you end up taking a train up to Camp McCoy?
Yeah, they put us in a train from the... We went to the induction center was on Van Buren Street in Chicago. And we were there all day long. And then they put us on trains to go to Camp McCoy. And the trains were from World War One, I'm sure. They were all wood, you know, the, and they went about 2 miles an hour. But we got to Camp McCoy late at night, and then we went through a test. So we got off the train. We went through a test where you would put earphones on, and you record whether you're hearing dashes or dots. And I never found out what the result was. It was a bad time to give it. You know, all of us were half asleep. But I don't know. They probably were looking for somebody at the aptitude of the signal corps.
Okay.
I imagine.
Yeah, to be a radio operator.
Yeah,
maybe?
Right. So, and then all we did was march. God, we walked all over the state of Wisconsin. And when I had a chance to get out of there, that's the first thing I did. I applied for that ASCP. And I went to Michigan State for about 3 weeks. And that was just a... just to get us accustomed, I think, to college life, you know, because then we went to Penn State. And at the time we went to Penn State, it was probably the most beautiful college you ever saw in your life. I don't know how many people were there. It wasn't real big, but it was a beautiful campus. And I went there after I was out of the Army about 10 years or more. I was doing a job in Pennsylvania, and I thought, I'm going to run by there and see. I stayed a half hour. It's a big city. You know, they've got highways going in and out of there now. They got a new stadium. They probably got 10 times the number of people they had before. You know, it's just the town is crowded. Before it was, you know, very sparse. But, yeah, that was a shocker to me. I didn't stay there long at all, you know. It was nothing. I'm used to big cities.
Sounds like a lot had changed in 10 years.
Oh, boy, and how. Yeah.
Can you describe what the ASTP program was for?
It was, the whole program was basically to provide college graduates, to have people that were trained in engineering, medical, any of the disciplines, because they felt that at the rate the draft was going, there wouldn't be any professionals. You know, they were taking them all. So the part I was in an engineering branch of the ASCP. It's Army Specialized Training Program. That's what it meant. And they had two different branches. If you had some college, you could start out as a junior, you know. So that was one group. And then the rest of us started out as freshmen. So, but it wasn't easy. I think we went to school from 8 in the morning till 5, and then there was mandatory study until, I think, 8, you know. It wasn't easy at all.
Sounds very intense.
Yeah, yeah.
So how long were you in this program?
3 semesters. I was in there 9 months, and then it broke up.
Okay. And why did the Army break up that program?
The people that had their sons in the Army complained. They complained that we were in college and their kids were in the Army. So... That did it.
So then after ASTP broke up, where did the Army send you?
They sent me to Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania, only for, I think I was there probably a week at the most. And they had 3,000 come in there from all the eastern schools. And then they told us they were going to keep half, and half were going to be shipped out. So he said to watch, make sure you watch the bulletin board, you know, because your name will be on it if you're going to get shipped out. Well, they had a real good laundry at Indian Hound Gap. You could get all your clothes washed in 2 days. So I thought, I better get all mine washed. I sent everything I owned to the laundry, and the laundry burnt down. And so then I got my orders to go to Florida. So I had winter clothes, and everybody else had summer clothes. So I got down there, and the first time I fell out, they assigned me to a tent with three other individuals. Well, they were all from the regular army, the other three guys. And the first time I met the sergeant, it was the second day, so everybody fell out. He took one look at me and he said, "You're out of uniform." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "What'd you do with the summer clothes?" I said, "The laundry burnt down." "That's a lot of BS. You sold them." I said, "I didn't sell them." I said, "Call the laundry." Well, then we get into this big hassle about that. And so he said, "You go down and get fatigues from the supply sergeant." The only ones he had were blue with a hole in the knee. Now, I'm not too sure about that. I think that they may have tried to teach me something, you know. Yeah. But I got off to a bad start. They had a board that was 2x6. It had spikes in it, and with ropes on the end, and that was to smooth the sand out. So you can't win the war with lumpy sand, you know. So they said, you know, "You and you," that was my new name, "pull this board up and down the street." So this other guy and I did that. Well, then you're last in the chow line, you know, because it takes 10, 15 minutes to do that. So, okay, we did that, and then we went out to this island, and we worked all day, either putting spikes in, pointing out the sea, or putting the actual fortifications in. And, he says, the second day, he said, "You and you, the same two, myself and this other guy." And I said, "Not me." And I thought he was going to die. He turned every color in the rainbow. "You realize you're talking back to a sergeant?" I said, "Yeah, I know." He said, "Do you know what the requirements are?" I said, "I don't care. I'll do it when everybody else does it. When this squad does it, I'll gladly do it. But I'm not doing it every day. Do you want to go and see the commanding officer?" I said, "Yeah, let's go." So down we go. And I thought, I'm going to really get it, you know. So he said, "You wait out here." So I wait outside the tent. And I heard him talking to the commanding officer. And he said, "The men are complaining about pulling that board up and down the street because we've got prisoners that should do it." Well, the prisoners were guys that the day before, you ran them coffee, you know, everybody you knew. The Navy had their own brig in that, but we just had a small, wired-in area. And these guys, we'd go and get them coffee and get them cigarettes. You know? So the commanding officer said to him, "Well, why don't you have the prisoners pull it?" You know, so that's what it turned out to be. So it took a while, but after a couple of months, he and I became pretty good friends.
Now, was part of the problem they gave you because you were a draftee and they were regular Army?
I was, yeah, that was part of it. And they didn't like us. We came from colleges, and 90% of them probably, you know, well, the two of the guys in the tent couldn't read or write. You know, they told me, they said their father told them they better get in the Army because he didn't have any money to feed them. You know, the Depression was just about ending, and the people didn't have any money. Okay. So that's what a lot of them wound up to be. Okay. And so
And here you are, a couple of college boys.
Yeah, right.
See, coming from up north.
And then I found out another thing that it would make them upset. I think that they had originally, before we got there, that battalion had like 600 compliments in it. Well, ASTP sent 88 guys in there. And a lot of their friends got shipped out somewhere. So I didn't find that out till much later. But that was another factor that kind of broke things up. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you eventually smoothed things out with
that.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. It worked out.
Okay.
But
so what other responsibilities did you have down in Florida?
Staying out of the sergeant's way. No, we built the fortifications that the Germans used.
Okay.
And then we blew them up.
Okay.
You know. But, yeah, that island was, we were the only ones on it. You know. Now I imagine it's all condos. You know. See, once air conditioning came to Florida, that really did it. That Fort Pierce, now that was all military. There were no civilians on that thing at all. There was our battalion, and then there were 20,000 sailors. And the whole island was there. There was no homes. Well, I talked to a guy recently. He said, it's all homes now, you know. Both that island and all those other islands on there, they're all built up. So
all that beachfront property.
Yeah. So.
So what was the point of building these fortifications?
Well, because they wanted to find out how effective it would be to blow them up.
Okay. Now, would you actually blow them up yourself?
Yeah.
Can you describe that process to us?
Well, what we would do is we'd take C4, which is an explosive, and plant it in certain places in those things and see how effective it would be. And one thing they tried to do, and it didn't work, they had us lay out a big triangle with black roofing paper, and they had bombs planted in that triangle. The bombs had no explosive in them, they had detonators only, so you could tell if they would go off or not. And then they had the Air Force try and bomb them, but the Air Force couldn't hit the target. Now, I don't know if that was on purpose, you know, may have been on purpose. But then what we did, we built a thing to hold the bomb, and we put the bomb right in the middle of that triangle, and it was on a tripod. And then we'd back off in a light tank, and we'd set it off, and then go out and measure how far it would detonate. So they give them some idea how effective it would be. And one of the things that we made a gross mistake in is we had these sharpened rails. They were actually pieces of railroad, and they were sharpened, and we would plant them, and that would be just like the Germans had those things. We'd have to find a way to get in. And so we were out there with this, they call it a water buffalo. It's a vehicle that will go on land or sea. And we were having a great time driving it, you know. We had this stuff all done so we wouldn't have anything to do the rest of the day, and we were taking turn driving it. And one time, one of the guys said, "Hey, I can't see the spikes. The tide came in." And the lieutenant who was in charge of us at the time, he said, "I know where it's at." He said, "I'll tell you, you know." And we all kind of looked at him. So he took it all right, and the spikes worked. They sunk the thing, you know, right through the bottom, and down it went. And it wasn't a real deep, you know, they were probably up to their shoulders when the thing went down. But and then another goofy thing happened. They took us, well, we had target practice, you know, they had a range set up. And they also said they were going to have us fire 50 caliber machine guns. So we went to an isolated beach, and they had an old TBF plane pulling its sock, and then we'd fire it as it went by. Well, the engine quit, and everybody was like, I didn't hit it. Well, nobody hit it. The thing just quit. And the fellow operating the target, he cut it loose right away, you know. And this guy, piloting the plane, he came down where the water was probably knee high, maybe, and he landed okay. And then a wave came in and flipped the plane over. So he, the pilot, and this guy were hanging there, and every time a wave came in, they'd get a face full. So that only took a minute to get him out of there. But okay. The pilot, the tail operator, was raising hell with the pilots. He said, I told you this thing was no good to start with. No. But
that must have been kind of scary for you initially, thinking, I shot down that plane.
Yeah. But
the crew was okay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just a little angry?
Yeah. But, yeah, it was interesting down there. And they had us practice landings off of a barge, you know, off of a landing barge. And,
What was that like?
Well, you know, they took us out on a destroyer, and we had to go down off the ropes and into the landing barge.
Okay.
And that's more difficult than it looks. This thing is going up and down, and the destroyer is going up and down. And, you know, yeah. But it was funny because they had half the battalion they had as an opposing force. They had those guys on the beach already, and the rest of us were on this destroyer, and we had to make a landing. So we made the landing, and these guys that were on the shore were giving us a hard time. They'd run towards us with a light tank or a jeep, and we'd have to get out of the way. Until one time, one of the guys I was with decided to throw rocks at him, and that did it. He broke a couple of windows in the jeep, and we caught hell for that, you know. And the guy he was raising hell with, what he wants to do? They're trying to kill us, you know. But
well, it was good practice,
right? Right.
Realistic.
Yeah, so that we left there and we went to, I want to say Camp Pickett. I think that's the one we went to. And that was the final staging area.
Where was Camp Pickett?
It was near Boston. It wasn't well known, you know. They kept it quiet, but the ships left from Boston. The night I left the States, I went on the New Amsterdam. That was the world's sixth larger. And that ship was caught in New York when the war started. So the United States took it over, and they stripped the whole inside and made a troop carrier out of it. So there were, I'm trying to think of the exact number. I know the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth left the same time we did. And one of them had 6,000 on it, and the other had 8,000. I think we had 5. And I thought they'd go in a convoy, you know. And the next day I got up and I looked around, there's no other ships around. And I asked one of the sailors, and I said, where are the rest of the ships? He said, they're not going to be any more ships. He said, we have sonar. And he said, we can detect a submarine, and we outrun it. We're much faster. Okay. He said, this is our 65th trip. You know, so apparently it must work.
Yeah, I guess they know what they're doing.
Yeah. But, yeah, that was, it took us 5 days, I think, to cross.
That's pretty fast.
Yeah.
It was a fast ship.
Coming back, I was on a Liberty ship. Everything was going great. We left Bremerhaven, and we were going 400 miles a day. And we got right in the middle of the Atlantic, and there was the damnedest storm you ever saw in your life. The ship was going 1 mile an hour.
Oh boy.
And everything come out of the water. The screws come out. The whole ship shook. I thought we hit something. You know, the whole boat just went like that. And every time it come out of the water, they had it only going 1 mile an hour, and they snapped the shaft. So that went on for 3 days. Yeah, it took us 8 days to get home. But and it was jammed. Ooh, boy. Jammed with people, you know, they're in the bunks at four high and all that.
But, did a lot of people get seasick?
Oh, yeah. All it takes is a couple.
Then it spreads.
Right. Yeah.
So on your trip from Boston to Europe, where did you land in England?
In Europe? It should say in there.
Let's see.
That thing's hard to read, but they're...
But you did end up landing in Great Britain somewhere?
Yeah.
Oh, Scotland.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so when you landed in Scotland, what did you have to do next?
Get on a train and go to Liverpool. Okay.
Always on the move.
Right. Yeah. We were transferred, I think, 6 times in about 2 weeks. It seemed like we'd get moved every time we turn around, they'd move us to another place. I don't know why. That was my introduction to Buzz Bomb. I was in a Union Park, I think they call the town, and we were in small tents, and I heard this thing. I heard it going, you know, you could tell because it wasn't an aircraft engine. And they putter like, and then when it stops, then you start to worry. So the thing stopped, and I had my fingers crossed, and it landed about, I would say maybe 2 blocks away.
That's pretty close.
Yeah. See, they didn't know where they were landing. The Germans were shooting those things. They knew they were hitting England, but they couldn't tell where. Yeah. But
so those were kind of a primitive missile.
Yeah.
They fly over from Germany to bomb England.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they were working on one to bomb New York, you know, but, I had, you know, quite a few close calls. I never get hit, fortunately.
Yeah, you were lucky.
Yes. We did one thing I described in there. We were, you know, we had K rations to eat, and I forget what else, but, we went into a town, and we took over one of the homes, which was pretty common practice because we felt the Germans wouldn't shell their own houses, which was a mistake. They did it anyhow. But we were in this home, and some one of these guys got a brainstorm. We should have a good meal instead of Kmart. So the thing was backed up to a river. The back of the house was almost in the river, it was right up to it. So one of the guys took a couple of blocks of C4 and threw it in the river. We had all the fish we could eat. And they, most of these fellows were from the south, and they knew how to cook fish. So they set up, one guy's gathering them out of the river. They got a table set up by a window that goes to the kitchen. And these guys are cleaning the fish and passing them through the window. And one guy's rolling them in flour and that and cooking them. And we had the seat was probably twice as long as this. And we had the woman's sheets. She had clean sheets, and we made a tablecloth. And we found candles, and we put them out. And we took her silverware and her plates, and we had those all set. So then we had, you know, we had a real meal going. And our commanding officer came in. And at first he was shocked. Then he sat down on the But That was funny.
You guys showed a lot of initiative. Made your officer happy. So you went from, Southampton, England, over to...
Lahar,
okay. Yeah. Now, you mentioned in here that you were... one of your duties was to man a 20-millimeter anti-aircraft gun?
Yeah. I never had any practice.
I was going to say, did you get any training on that?
No, they said if you see a plane, pull the trigger.
Well, luckily, you didn't see a plane.
No. It was nighttime, you know.
Okay. So then you ended up in France at Le Havre?
Yeah.
What was your first impression of landing in France?
I'll tell you what my impression was. Was not so much arriving in France, but when we went from France to Germany, the difference was marked. France, the farms and that were pretty shabby. In Germany, they weren't. You didn't see a stick on the ground in Germany. They were, I think, charged with taking care of the highway in front of their property.
Okay.
And so it was a big difference. But, of course, the towns were ruined, absolutely ruined. I stood in some towns where I could see the other end without a wall. Ooh. Not a wall was standing, you know. And I was one of the first ones in Schweinfurt.
Oh.
Yeah. And we were mixed in with the infantry, and they had us go in, and they had us take a listing of any safes, and we were to blow them open. They wanted the production records. And there was only a few good buildings in that big town. And one of the buildings was okay. It was a two-story brick building. And we went up to the second floor, and it was a big safe against the wall like that. So we're explosive experts, this other guy and I. We're both privates, you know. And he says, well, put a little C4 in that corner. I said, okay. Put some there. I think you better put some there. You know, we had that whole thing. And then we went outside, and we had the hell box. And he said, okay, when I count three, you turn it. I said, all right. One, two, three, I turned it. It blew the whole front of the building out. And as if they cut it out with a razor blade, and it blew that thing out the back wall. And it blew the door off of it. And there was a stale rye bread in there and a pair of shoes.
But you got it open.
Yeah, right.
So did you ever find any production records, or were they all gone?
No. They were building ball bearings to the day before we got there.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's what Schweinfurt was known for, the ball bearing factories?
Right. And the walls of the factory were as thick as this table here. And what they did, they threw all kinds of junk up on the roof. They had bricks and I-beams, and it blended in with the whole surrounding.
Okay.
From the air, you wouldn't know it was a factory.
So it was camouflage.
Yeah.
They made it look like a ruined building.
Yeah,
okay.
Right. And that whole town was frankly ruined. It got bombed really heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know a lot of Americans lost their lives trying to bomb it.
You know, but I never could understand the agreement that our Air Force had to bomb in the daytime. I never could understand that. They lost 66 B-17s the first time they raided it. You know, and there's 10 guys in each one.
Mm-hmm. And they never did knock it out.
No.
So what was your role as a combat engineer going through France and Germany? What did you have to do?
The main thing we did was build pontoon bridges.
Okay.
The other stuff was incidental.
Okay.
You know.
Can you describe a pontoon bridge for
Pardon
us?
Me?
Can you describe what a pontoon bridge is?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can see a river like the Chicago River, we could bridge it in 6 hours. And have the traffic going across it, you know. And those bridges were built in Caesar's time with wooden boats instead of the pneumatics. Okay. But the basic idea was the same, you know. What would happen, there's a unit called the Treadway Bridge Company, and that was not part of us at all. But it was a series of trucks, and each truck carried one section of the bridge. So they would start up here, and they'd inflate the boats and get all the stuff ready and then float them down, and then we would hook them all together, you know. The only thing that we got stuck doing that was kind of a lousy job is those bridges, you have to start with like a football goal post. It looks just like a goal post. It's got the two coming up, and it's got one going across. And the primary purpose of that is to get you up on the bridge. See, most of these things, you don't drive from solid ground right onto the bridge. They're usually, you have to go up normally. Well, for at least the width of the boat, you know. So that's the first thing you have to do. You have to get this thing set. And somebody's got to go in the water because they have what they call mud feet on them. They're sealed things about as big as a table here with a pole in the middle. So you got to get these things set level. So I got stuck with that job frequently. But one thing we did, we had a truck running. And I had extra clothes in that truck. And when I got out of the water, I set the Oil American speed record. But that's the first thing you had to do. You had to set that. Okay. And then the boats, though, I read a history about them. They go back a long time. And they were wood at first. And then there's some big ones. There's a couple that were a mile long. You can hook as many together. Like, I got a picture of the crossing of the Rhine, and they had pontoon boats. And those things, it must have been close to a half a mile long.
Yeah.
You know?
Because that's a very wide river.
Yeah.
Rhine.
Yeah.
So the pontoon bridge is basically a bunch of boats with the roadway laid on top of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What you have, you start with the boat. And then you have what they call wooden saddles. They put wooden units across the boats, and then the steel tracks go on. And you hook all the steel tracks together. So,
So what was it like driving across one of those? Did it go up and down a lot?
Well, you know, they bounce a little bit, but not too bad. You know, they have a lot of weight on them, so... they come like one guy. He never should have been on the thing. The road led down to it, and it was a one-way road. And he's in the middle of it in a tank, and the water's that far from swamping the boat, you know. So he made it across, but they should have, you know, weight limits on him.
Yeah. Because. So these things would even hold tanks.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
But it was, that part was interesting. And then we took down a lot of them. So we would build them.
Okay.
And then as the front advanced, we go back and recoup the other one. It was busy all the time. There was one stretch there where we traveled all day and worked all night. I mean, you know. We were just washed out because it was really going then. We built about seven of them in 7 days, you know.
Okay.
So
in your time in Europe, you must have built dozens and dozens of these.
Yeah, and we built a couple of permanent wooden bridges.
Oh.
We had two sergeants with us that were super carpenters. They were the only guys I knew that could start on both sides, me in the middle, you know. But they were really good. And it was funny. We were going to build one permanent bridge, and the burgomaster from the town asked us if they could build it. And the officer said, "Why, you know?" And he said, "Well, the way you guys are going to build it, it's going to flood this farmland." He said, "We'll build it, and it'll suit your needs, but there won't be any flooding." So the officer said, "Okay." Well, when they started to build it, they were almost fighting to use the tools. See, we had pneumatic hammers, pneumatic saws. They didn't have any of that. So, you know, they all wanted to use that stuff. Yeah.
So did they get that bridge built?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And it didn't flood the farms?
No. Okay. I'll tell you another goofy thing that happened, though. We were in a convoy. It was, I think, just our squad. No, more than that. It must have been our company. There probably was about 8 trucks or 9 trucks. And the one truck had a flat tire. So the officer and the first sergeant come back and I said, "Can you fix the tire?" The guy says, "Yeah, we can fix the tire." Well, they took off. And I said, "Do you know where we're going?" Nobody knew. I said, "Are you telling me that you let those guys take off and here we are?" Well, we had to start down a road, and if we saw people run, we'd turn around and go somewhere else. You know, we didn't know where we were at, and they didn't know where they were going. So we went, and finally we went into a town. We were on the edge of a town, and we got another flat tire. So the truck driver stopped, and he said, "Can you fix it?" And he said, "Yeah, I can fix it, and I'll have a couple of guys with me." So there was a farm there, and there were a couple of buildings. And like everybody else, they're nosy, and they said, "We're going to go into that barn over there." So off they go, and we're sitting in a truck, and they don't come back, you know. And I finally said to the one guy, I said, "Let 3 or 4 of us go and see what's going on in the barn." So we get out of the truck, and we give it a John Wayne deal, kick the door down and all that, you know. And there they are, the guys from our company, and the farmers that were released, because that infantry unit just went through, and the Germans had them working on the farm. So there they are, and they were all drinking wine. The first thing they did was grab the farmer's wine. They're all getting stiff, you know. And they learned to say, "Here's to you" in Russian, and the Russians learned to say, "Here's to you" in English. So they were there for I don't know how long. Well, we finally convinced them we got to go, you know. So we get in the truck, and we're only no more than a half a mile from the town. And as we approach the town, we saw that there was a big meeting, and what had happened, that unit was going into the town, and there were white sheets and white flags out, which meant they surrendered. And somebody leaned out the window and shot and killed the lieutenant. And the captain got a hold of the burgomaster, and he said, "You get everybody in this town, in this square, or else I'm going to kill you." Well, he got them all in the square, and he told them, he said, "Now I want you to repeat to these people that if there's one more shot fired, we're leaving the town of Bologna without the man." And he was really mad. Whew. You know.
Yeah.
But, you know, they surrender and then
they shoot somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I assume you didn't have any more trouble there?
Yeah. You know, people are goofy, though. There's, there were two guys that went wandering off one night. We were in a town, and they had no business leaving the town, you know, or leaving the group. And the two of them took off, and they went into a town, and a woman come out of the one of the houses, and she said, "Aren't you afraid?" And this guy says, "No, we're not afraid. We're from a regiment, and they're going to blow this town off the map if we don't come back." So she said, "Well, wait a minute." She went in, and 75 Germans surrendered. Now they couldn't do anything. They couldn't tell anybody, because they shouldn't have been there to start with. And the next night, the same two guys did the same thing, and they separated, and the one guy was killed. You know, you're right, and I don't care if they're civilians or what they are. You may have killed their father, brother, mother, family, you know. There's no friends over there, you know.
Boy.
Yeah.
Then you mentioned in your story here about riding a French train, a 40 and 8.
Yeah.
Can you describe that for us?
Oh, geez. Well, those things are about as big as a table there, you know. And the reason they got that name, they held 8 horses or 40 men. Well, if they held 40 men, they were skinny and they squeezed together. But anyhow, they put us on that thing, and the trains over there, if they ran 15 minutes in a row, it would be something. They'd be stopping all the time. And they'd sit for a while, and then they'd go, and, you know. So they stopped, and there was one guy came and said there was a place set up to feed the truck drivers, and they would feed us, and there were all French girls waiting at the tables. Well, you know, that's all they had to say, and about 4 of us or 5 of us went in there. We were having a great time, you know. Well, finally some guy came in and said, "You are in big trouble. They got the train held up waiting for you." So we had to go there, and the commanding officer said, "You're restricted to these boxcars. You're not to get off of them no matter what." And, you know, and we're in there squeezed. So and I know what happened. A guy, 2 cars in back of us, got sick. And I guess he was really sick, because the doctor that we had with us and the commanding officer went back there. And while they were there, the train started up. So the one guy jumped between the cars on the coupling. The captain that we were with went to open the doors, and one of the guys that were in the car with me, they told him to go around the other side, and he slammed the door shut.
On the captain?
And he was hanging on the side of the car on a ladder. Well, then he saw a signal post coming, and he would have got knocked off. And all he had was, he had a t-shirt on, it was winter time, and his suntans, or his winter pants, but just his t-shirt. And one guy said, finally this thing stopped, and one guy opened the door, he said, "Are we in trouble?" The captain was knocking on the door, and the last time I saw him, he was rolling down the hill in the snow. And the other guy stood between the couplings, or between the cars, and he survived it okay. He didn't, you know, but the captain, he came. Oh, we said we're gonna really catch it. So we got to, that may have been Looneyville. We got there, and after dinner, we had a fire going, and we were sitting by the fire, and one guy looked up, he said, "Look who's coming," and it was Captain Keller. And I said, "Oh, man." You know, so he walked up to us, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you, I'll never make a good hobo." And he died. So, what's he going to say, you know?
Well, it sounded like he was a good sport about
yeah,
it.
So. Yeah. But that...
You mentioned here, too, that you did some training for the infantry on how to detect mines.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you describe that to us?
Well, the first thing we did, we had to go and get a bunch of batteries, because the detectors use the batteries. And we had about maybe five detectors. And what we would do, we wouldn't have explosives in the mines. See, we'd plant the field,
okay,
but we'd have the detonators only. So if you stepped on one, or that, you wouldn't get hurt. And that's what we did. We taught them how to demine them if you have to. But for the most part, we would put a half pound block of TNT in them and blow them up. You know, because you can't fool with them. You know, the Germans, what they would do, they'd have the minefield here, and they'd have some mines in it, but here's a tree, and they knew that somebody's going to get behind the tree. So they put a mine right there. You know, any place that outside of the minefield that you think you would go for cover. So.
Now, did the Germans also have wooden mines, or were they all metal?
They were metal. I never saw any wooden ones.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you could always detect them?
Yeah.
With your detectors?
Yeah.
Okay, then you also mentioned, you saw an air raid over while you were crossing the Rhine River in Germany?
Well, yeah.
During the night?
When we crossed the Rhine, I'd say for 2 hours before that, there was nothing but bombers that went over. And then when the actual crossing was going to take place, the sky was lit up with artillery. They must have had a, you know, hub to hub. And I don't know how many bombers went over, a couple hours. And, you know, if they couldn't convince the Germans that the war was lost, nothing would. You know, boy.
So you were in Germany up until the very end of the war?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, in Austria, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were in Austria when the war ended?
Yeah.
Okay.
Austria is a beautiful country. Oh. Just, first of all, it's very mountainous, but secondly, the houses look like they come out of a storybook. They're stucco. One is pink, one is blue, one is green, you know, just beautiful.
So, you were in Austria at the end of the war. Where were you when you heard the war ended?
Munich.
Did you have much of a celebration?
No, not really.
No.
No.
You mentioned here too about you had a duffel bag full of German marks.
Oh yeah, that was something else to you.
Was that from Schweinfurt also?
That was from Schweinfurt.
Okay.
I got a hold of the payroll, and I didn't think the money was any good. And I sat in the back of the truck, and every town we went through, I threw money out. I had my own Marshall Plan. They probably thought the Americans were great.
Now, how did you find that duffel bag?
Blown the safe open.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. It was the whole payroll for the big plant.
Then you also mentioned here about how you'd go house to house searching for weapons.
Oh, yeah.
And guns.
We get into a town, we'd seal the town off, and then we go through all of it. And another guy and I broke up shotguns that probably were worth a couple of $1,000 a piece. They were antiques, you know. We didn't care what they were. We busted them up and threw them in the river. And I had a good friend that was a AAA Yankee. He was 19 years old. And he pitched triple-A ball for the Yankees. So he and I are in this town. And at the end of the town, about a half a block away, looked like a sand pile. Hey, great big sand pile. So I told him, I said, you're the hot rod pitcher. Why don't you throw a grenade into the sand pile? So he said, I can do that. He pulls the plug and he throws it. And it was a magnesium grenade, which... they used to destroy guns, you know, and this thing burned right to the bottom. It was sawdust. It burned for 3 days.
So can you tell us about your responsibilities after the war ended, your occupation duties?
Yeah, well, one of them was to maintain roads. That's one of the things we did. And we did some cleanup work. Like we were going to move into a place that housed the Germans at one time. It was a big square training camp, and they had rooms on all four sides. So the sergeant says to me, get about six guys and get pails and mops and go across the way and clean up about a dozen rooms. I said, okay. So I get these guys and off we go. Well, after about maybe an hour, the sergeant says to me, go tell them to stop. I said, tell them to stop? He says, yeah, we're not going to move. So I go over there and I get a hold of this one guy who can speak a little English, and I told him. And all the rest of them started to laugh. And I said, what are they laughing at? They said, it's just like the German army.
His armies are all the same.
Yeah, right.
So, let's see. You mentioned being in Munich and, about the rules against fraternizing with the Germans?
Oh, yeah.
Was that strictly enforced?
Yeah, that wasn't enforced at all. I mean, guys, they were selling wristwatches. I was ready to go to England on a furlough. And a guy came up to me and said, would you change $200 for me from a German to English? And he said, I'll give you $50. I said, okay. So I changed it for him. And I said, are you going to England? He said, no, I make this trip twice a week. He's getting two or three times the money, two or three times a week.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I mean, you know, he'd be a millionaire in no time. But there was, I never saw him pinch anybody for fullback market. You know, that deal there was, yeah, something else again. One of the regulars, they're characters to start with, you know. But he and I were roomed together, and it was this big facility. One wing was blown out, and yet the whole battalion was in three wings, two to a room. So this guy, he makes two trips to the chow line. Because he's got a girlfriend living with us, a German girlfriend. And she tells him, if you guys sell cigarettes, I can show you where I can trade the cigarettes for scotch. And you can trade the scotch for $20 a bottle. Well, okay, you know, let's go. So we get with her, and she leads us. Down, you know, we're nuts going down dark streets and that. And we go into a tavern. There's not another American in there. And we get a lot of dirty looks. Well, she buys three steins of beer. One for her, one for me, and one for the guy that's with us. So she bumps the glasses, and she says, up your hats. And I almost fell over. And he says, don't laugh. I told her it means good luck. So then we go back to our room, and I get called out on guard duty. I'm gone for 3 days. And when I come back, the scotch is gone. I said, where's the scotch? He said, I threw a party. I said, oh, great, you know, you're a real hero.
Yeah. So much for making money.
Right. But can you imagine that? You know, you could buy cigarettes for 50 cents a carton. And I heard later that some of the wealthiest people were waiters in the GI clubs, the German waiters. They took all the butts and broke them open and rolled cigarettes.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. But
So when did you find out that you were finally done with the Army and were going to be able to go home?
Well, we knew pretty soon because Eisenhower put out an edict on points, so many points to be going. And you got so many points for being over there. These guys got a lot of points for being in Panama, you know. So most of them got out real quick. And I was going to get out, I think it's the 15th of February. And I think that sergeant that I had trouble with fixed things, I got on that damn boat on the 15th of February. And the thing was the Stevens Victory, which was a little boat. And we were going 400 miles a day, and they published a map. And we got right in the middle, and we hit a storm that I thought the boat was going to sink. It, in fact, another Stevens Victory had to put into Greenland because it cracked. The sea was so bad. It got down to where it only go 1 mile an hour, you know, and the front would come out, and then the back would come out. And the water had come over the top. Holy Moses.
Boy.
It was really bad. But, yeah, going over was not bad at all. We were fortunate, and we were the last ones loaded. And we slept on the deck on hammocks. And they had steel shutters that they closed the deck off so it'd be in the dark, you know. But that was better than being down in,
yeah,
in the bottom of the thing.
So did you pass your time gambling?
Yeah.
On the way home?
Okay. I'll tell you what, I made up my mind when I got on that boat that I was going to get off broke or with a new car. And I was broke before we left Bremerhaven. And I'm wandering around, and the only, I came back with one guy that I went across with. And he says to me, you'd like to get back in that game, wouldn't you? And I said, well, you know, if I could do something, yeah. He said, I'll back you. I said, I'll tell you what, you give me $20. If I lose, I'll send you 20. And if I win, I'll send you half the money. So he says, okay. I started with that 20, and I ran it up to 250, shooting craps. And then I said, shoot it. And these were all black guys in this game. And the guy said, go ahead. And I shot it, and I passed. And I said, I passed the dice. Give me the $500. Oh. Dude, they almost had a fit. And I said, they got mine yesterday, I got yours today. But when I gave him the 250, he was shocked.
Oh, great. So then you, what port did you land in the U.S. coming back home?
In New York. Yeah.
So what was that feeling like when you sailed by the Statue of Liberty?
Great. Yeah, great.
Was there much of a welcome for you when the ship landed?
Yeah, well, they had a fireboat there with the hoses going. Okay. And they took us to Camp Pickett and gave us a 7-course meal.
Wow, okay.
And then 2 years ago, I went on that honor flight, you know, and that was interesting. They had 90-some wheelchairs in that thing. Everybody on it was, you know, with it. When it started out, they said you could go alone or you could go with a companion. Okay. The companion had to pay for it.
Yes.
You know. And first they called me and said, well, you're not going to be able to go because you can't go alone. I said, well, that's the way it goes. They called back 2 days later and they said, well, you can go. And almost everybody on there, with the exception of maybe two out of the 96 guys, had to have somebody with them. Okay. You know, they had trouble walking or whatever. But, yeah, that was interesting.
So that was to Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, and we went to all the all the main places, you know.
You saw the World War II memorial?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really something. But, yeah, that was interesting. And when the interesting part was, when we took off, he had to make a circle and come back. They smelled smoke. And my son was with me. And he said, "Dad, when I got on this thing, I smelled smoke." And he said, "You know, not a lot, but," he says, "I could detect it." And it's, he said, "I'll bet it's an electrical fire." Now, he worked on cars all the time, so, you know, he's pretty familiar with the smells. And so we went back and landed. Everybody had to get off. They had to get on another plane. And then we took off again, you know.
That was kind of scary.
Right. Yeah. But coming back, my son never said a word. See, he had a, being a guardian to me, he had to go to a class, and it took almost all day up in Wilmette, I think. And anybody that was going to go as a guardian had to go to that class. And they explained everything. But they told him, "Don't say anything about the welcome home. Don't say a word," you know. And nobody did. And when we landed at Midway, first of all, I see all these lights flashing all over the place, and I thought, they're burning some up again, you know. But it was a welcome home. So Jim put me in a wheelchair, and he had to go up a ramp. And at the top of the ramp, there were three Air Force people. And our nameplates ran there. "Welcome home, Marty." Well, then I turned, and there must have been a couple thousand people.
Wow.
Okay. Really. They were from all over the place. So that was a real welcome home.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, that was great.
What was your welcome home like when you got back to Chicago?
Oh, my sister and my folks threw a big party for me. Yeah.
Did they know you were coming?
Yeah. Yeah, they knew. I don't think they knew exactly when, but they knew that I landed in New York, and they knew about what it would take, you know.
So then you took a train back from New York to Chicago?
Right. And then, yeah. You know, now they fly everybody, the services, you know.
So what was it like walking through the front door?
Oh, really good. Yeah. Yeah, that was a deal. Yeah. You know.
Were your parents home when you got home?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. My dad worked for the post office. My mother didn't work. She was, you know, was a housewife. And my uncle, that guy's a real story. I'm named after him. He, when he was 13 years old, he supported himself, my father, my aunt, my uncle. He worked from the time he was 13. Wow. And he was 85 when he died. He had one cavity in 85 years, and his glasses were 20/20 his eyes were 20/20 with glasses. Unbelievable.
Wow. Yeah. 13 years old.
Yeah. Well, you know, there were no welfare deals, you know.
No, back then?
No. No, you either made it or you didn't. Yeah.
Well, any other last thoughts or any other stories you want to share with us?
What's it?
Any other last thoughts that you want to share with us?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing your memories with us today.
You're more than welcome. Yes. I keep this or you guys get it.